When the figure urged him to take courage and attempt to recover their freedom, he said he was powerless to do so, for the tribe from which he came was too small, and he himself was young and too weak for such great undertakings. But God himself promised to make up what was lacking and to grant victory to the Israelites while he commanded. Gideon then told this to some of the young men, and they believed him. At once an army of 10,000 men stood ready for the struggle. But God, appearing to Gideon in his sleep, showed him that human nature is inclined to self-regard and hostile to those who excel in virtue, and that if they won with so great a host, thinking themselves a match for the enemy, they would set aside God's role in the victory and consider it their own. So that they might learn the outcome depended on his help, God advised that around midday, at the height of the heat, he should lead the army to the river, and that those who lay down and drank in that posture should be judged brave, while those who drank hastily and in a hurry should be reckoned cowardly and terrified of the enemy. When Gideon did as God instructed, 300 men were found who brought the water to their mouths with their hands, fearfully and in disorder. And God said these were the men with whom he should take on the enemy. The Midianites were encamped beyond the Jordan, intending to cross over the next day. Gideon, being afraid, for God had told him beforehand to attack by night, was told, in order to relieve him of his fear, to take one of his soldiers and go near the tents of the Midianites, for from the enemy themselves he would gain confidence and courage. Persuaded, he went, taking with him his own servant Phurah, and drawing near a certain tent, he found the men in it awake, one of them recounting a dream to his tent companion, in such a way that Gideon overheard it. The dream was this: a barley loaf, too poor a thing for men to eat, seemed to roll through the camp and knock down the king's tent and all the soldiers' tents with it. The man judged the vision to portend destruction for the army, explaining how he had come to this conclusion. Barley, of all grains, is agreed to be the cheapest, and of all the peoples of Asia, the Israelites can now be seen to be the most despised, resembling this cheap grain. And whatever now shows spirit among the Israelites, he said, must be Gideon and the army with him. Since then you say you saw the loaf overturning our tents, I fear that God has granted Gideon victory over us. Hearing this dream, Gideon was filled with good hope and courage, and ordered his own men to take up arms, telling them also of the enemy's vision. They, emboldened by what he described, stood ready for his commands. At about the fourth watch, Gideon led his army forward, having divided it into three companies of 100 men each. All of them carried empty jars with torches burning inside, so that their approach would not be discovered by the enemy, and in their right hand a ram's horn, which they used in place of a trumpet. The enemy's army occupied a great stretch of ground, for they had an enormous number of camels, and, distributed by nation, they all lay together within a single circle. The Hebrews, as instructed, once they drew near the enemy, at a given signal sounded their horns, broke their jars, and rushed forward with the torches, shouting their war cry, trusting God to grant Gideon's victory, and this they did. Confusion and terror seized the men, still half asleep, for it was night and God willed it so. Few were killed by the enemy proper, most died at the hands of their own allies, owing to the confusion of languages. Once panic took hold, they cut down whatever they came upon, taking it for the enemy, and there was great slaughter. When word of Gideon's victory reached the Israelites, they took up arms, and pursuing the enemy caught them in a hollow ringed by ravines that could not be crossed, and surrounding them, killed them all, including two of their kings, Oreb and Zeb. The rest of the commanders, leading the remaining soldiers, there were 18,000 of them, encamped at a great distance from the Israelites. Gideon, however, was not worn out or ready to give up. Pursuing with his entire army and engaging them, he destroyed the enemy utterly and brought back the remaining commanders, Zebah and Zalmunna, as captives. About 120,000 of the Midianites and their Arab allies died in this battle, and much plunder, gold, silver, fine cloth, camels, and pack animals fell to the Hebrews. Gideon, arriving at Ophrah, his hometown, put the Midianite kings to death. The tribe of Ephraim, resentful of Gideon's success, had resolved to march against him, complaining that he had not informed them in advance of his undertaking against the enemy. Gideon, being a moderate man and supreme in every virtue, did not claim to have attacked the enemy on his own initiative and by his own judgment without them, but said God had commanded it, and declared the victory to belong no less to them than to those who had actually fought. By these words, he soothed their anger, and in doing so benefited the Hebrews even more than by his success against the enemy, for he saved them from what would have become civil strife just as it was beginning. That tribe, however, would later pay the penalty for this insolence, as we shall relate at its proper time. Gideon, wishing to lay down his authority, was compelled to keep it, and held it for 40 years, rendering just judgments for the people. Whatever he pronounced in disputes brought before him was final. He died in old age and was buried in Ophrah, his hometown. He had 70 legitimate sons, for he had married many wives and one illegitimate son by a concubine from Shechem, named Abimelech, who, after his father's death, withdrew to Shechem to his mother's relatives. For that was his origin, and, taking money from them, men notorious for the great number of their crimes, came with them to his father's house and killed all his brothers except Jotham, who managed to escape and so was saved. Abimelech then turned the government into a tyranny, making himself master to do whatever he wished in place of the laws, and dealing harshly with those who stood up for justice. On one occasion, when a public festival was being held at Shechem and the whole populace had gathered there, his brother Jotham, the one we said had escaped, went up onto the on Mount Gerizim, which rises above the city of Shechem, and shouted loudly enough for the crowd to hear. When they had fallen silent to listen, he asked them to hear what he had to say, and once quiet had settled, he spoke. He said that the trees, having once had a human voice, had come together in an assembly and asked the fig tree to rule over them. The fig tree refused, since the honor paid to its fruit was its own and did not come to it from outside. And so the trees did not give up their concern for finding a ruler, and it seemed good to them to offer the honor to the vine. The vine, when chosen, used the same words as the fig tree and declined the office. The olive trees did the same, so the trees asked the thorn bush to take up the kingship, since it is good at supplying kindling from its wood, and it promised to take up the rule and do so without hesitation, provided, however, that the trees would gather beneath its shade. And if they had destruction in mind against it, they would be consumed by the fire within it. "I do not say this," he went on, "for the sake of a joke, but because you, who have experienced many good things from Gideon, are letting Abimelech, who joined with you in killing his brothers, hold power over everything, though he is no different from fire." Having said this, he withdrew and lived in hiding in the mountains for 3 years in fear of Abimelech. Not long after the festival, the Shechemites, for they had come to regret the murder of Gideon's sons, drove Abimelech out of the city and the tribe, and he began plotting to harm the city. When the season for gathering the grape harvest came, they were afraid to go out and collect the fruit, lest Abimelech do them some harm. But when one of the officers, Gaal, arrived among them with armed men and his own kinsmen, the Shechemites asked him to provide them protection until they had finished the harvest. He agreed to their request, and they went out with Gaal, who brought his own armed force along. So the harvest was gathered in safety, and as they feasted by companies, they grew bold enough to openly curse Abimelech, while the officers, catching men in ambushes around the city, seized and killed many of Abimelech's people. Now a certain Zabulus, one of the rulers of Shechem and a guest friend of Abimelech, sent messengers to inform him of everything Gaal was stirring up the people to do, and advised him to lie in ambush before the city, for he would persuade Gaal to come out against him, and after that it would be in Abimelech's power to take revenge. For once this had happened, Zabulus would negotiate a reconciliation for him with the people. So Abimelech took his position in ambush, while Gaal, less on his guard, was spending time in the suburb together with Zabulus. When Gaal saw armed men advancing, he said to Zabulus that men in arms were coming against them. Zabulus replied that these were the shadows of the rocks, but as the men drew nearer and their outlines became clear, he said, "Those are not shadows, but a band of armed men." And Zabulus said, "Was it not you who accused Abimelech of cowardice? Why not show now the greatness of your courage by engaging him in battle?" Gaal, thrown into confusion, joined battle with Abimelech's men. Some of those with him fell, and he himself fled into the city, bringing the rest with him. Zabulus then worked to have Gaal expelled from the city, accusing him of having fought feebly against Abimelech's soldiers. Abimelech, learning that the Shechemites were about to go out again at the time of the grape harvest, set ambushes around the city. And when the people came out, a third part of his army seized the gates to cut off the citizens' way back in, while the rest chased down those who had scattered, and there was killing everywhere. He razed the city to the ground, since it could not hold out against the siege, and sowed salt over the ruins as he advanced. All the Shechemites perished in this way, but those who had escaped the danger by scattering through the countryside found a strong rock and settled on it, preparing to fortify it. Abimelech, learning of their intention, moved quickly against them with his forces and had bundles of dry wood carried and piled around the place, ordering his army to do this. Once the rock had been quickly surrounded on all sides with the wood, they threw fire onto it, using whatever kindled most readily, and raised a great blaze. No one escaped from the rock. Men, women, and children perished together, about 1,500 men, and a considerable number of others besides. Such was the disaster that fell upon the people of Shechem, greater even than the grief it caused, except that it was just. They had joined with a man to do so great a wrong against their own benefactor. Abimelech, having terrified the Israelites with the sufferings of the Shechemites, was clearly reaching for even greater things and showed no sign of setting a limit to his violence unless he destroyed everyone. He therefore marched against Thebes and took the city by a sudden assault. But there was a great tower in it, into which the whole population had fled for refuge, and he prepared to besiege it. As he rushed close to the gates, a woman struck him on the head with a piece of a millstone she threw down. Abimelech fell and begged his armor-bearer to kill him so that his death would not be thought the work of a woman. The man did as he was ordered. So Abimelech paid the penalty for his crime against his brothers and for the outrages he had dared against the people of Shechem. This disaster befell them in accordance with Jotham's prophecy. When Abimelech fell, the army that was with him scattered and returned to their homes. Leadership of the Israelites then passed to Jair of Gilead, of the tribe of Manasseh, a man prosperous in other respects and blessed with 30 fine sons, all excellent horsemen, who had been entrusted with the governance of the cities of Gilead. He held the leadership for 22 years, died at an advanced age, and was thought worthy of burial in the city of Cammon in Gilead. Now the whole conduct of the Hebrews had degenerated into disorder and contempt for God and the laws, and the Ammonites and Philistines, despising them for it, plundered the country with a great army. Having seized all of Perea, they were even venturing to cross over and take possession of the rest as well. The Hebrews, chastened by their sufferings, turned to supplicate God and brought sacrifices, imploring him to soften his anger and, moved by their entreaty, to relent. God, changing to a gentler disposition, was about to help them. When the Ammonites had marched against Gilead, the local people met together on the mountain, asking for someone to lead them in war. There was a certain Jephthah, a man of power because of his father's valor and because of the private force of mercenaries he himself maintained. They sent to him and asked him to fight on their side, promising to give him the leadership over them for all time to come. He would not accept their appeal and reproached them for not helping him when he had been openly wronged by his brothers, for he was not their full brother by the same mother, but a stranger. His mother had been brought to his father's house out of erotic desire, and, despising his weakness, they had driven him out. So he had gone to live in the region called Gilead, taking in for pay anyone who came to him from wherever they might be. When the elders of Gilead pleaded with him and swore that they would grant him the leadership forever, he took the field. He moved quickly to set matters in order, and stationing his army at the city of Mizpah, he sent an embassy to the king of Ammon to complain of the seizure of the land. The king sent back word, charging the Israelites over their exodus from Egypt and demanding that they give up the land of the Amorites as territory that had belonged to his ancestors from the beginning. Jephthah replied that their ancestors had no just complaint against the Amorites, and that the Ammonites ought rather to be grateful, since it had been in Moses' power to take their land too, but he had spared it and called it their own land, which, once God had won it for them, they had held for 300 years. He said he would fight them, and having said this to the envoys, he sent them away. He himself, having prayed for victory, and vowed that if he returned safe to his home, he would sacrifice as a burnt offering whatever should first meet him, engaged the enemy and won a decisive victory, pursuing and slaughtering them as far as the city of Maenaiath. Crossing into Ammonite territory, he destroyed many cities, drove off plunder, and freed his own people from the slavery they had endured for 18 years. On his way back, he met with a disaster in no way like the successes he had won. For his daughter came out to meet him, his only child, and still a virgin. He cried out in anguish at the magnitude of the blow and reproached his daughter for her eagerness in coming out to meet him, for he had vowed to dedicate her to God. She, however, took what was to happen without dismay, since it came with her father's victory and her people's freedom, and though she must die for it, she asked only that he grant her 2 months to go and mourn her lost youth with her companions before he carried out his vow. He agreed to the time she had named, and when it had passed, he sacrificed his daughter, offering her up as a burnt offering, a sacrifice neither lawful nor pleasing to God, since he had not weighed carefully in his own mind how such an act, once done, would appear to those who heard of it. When the tribe of Ephraim marched against him, angry that he had not shared with them the campaign against the Ammonites, but had kept both the plunder and the glory of what had been done for himself alone, he told them first that their kinsmen had not gone unnoticed while under attack, and that they, though called on for help, had not come, though they ought to have hastened to their aid even before being asked. And second, that they were now trying to do wrong to their kinsmen, having not dared to face the enemy in battle. He warned that with God's help he would exact justice from them if they did not come to their senses. When this failed to persuade them, and they engaged him with an army that had been summoned from Gilead, he inflicted heavy losses on them, and as he pursued them in their route, having sent a detachment ahead to seize the fords of the Jordan, he killed about 42,000 of them. Jephthah himself, having ruled for 6 years, died and was buried in his own home city of Sebi, in Gilead. After Jephthah's death, Abzan succeeded to the leadership, a man of the tribe of Judah from the city of Bethlehem. He had 60 children, 30 sons, and the rest daughters, all of whom he lived to see married, the daughters given to husbands, the sons provided with wives. He accomplished nothing worth recording or remembering in the 7 years of his rule, and died at an advanced age, receiving burial in his native city. After Abzan's death in this way, the man who took up the leadership after him, Elon of the tribe of Zebulun, held it for 10 years and accomplished nothing of note either. Abdon, son of Elon, of the tribe of Ephraim and from the city of the Perathonites, was appointed sole ruler after Elon, and would be remembered only for the number of his children, since he himself accomplished no notable deed, owing to the peace and security of the times. He had 40 sons, and left behind, through these, 30 grandsons, and he used to ride out together with all 70 of them, every one an excellent horseman. He died at an advanced age, leaving all of them alive, and received a splendid burial at Perathon. After his death, the Philistines overpowered the Israelites and took tribute from them for 40 years. They were freed from this compulsion in the following way. A certain man, of the Danites, outstanding among the few and acknowledged as first in his homeland, had a wife renowned for her beauty and unsurpassed among the women of her time. Since they had no children, he was distressed at his childlessness and repeatedly went with his wife to the plain outside the city to entreat God to grant them true offspring, for this is a large plain. He was also madly in love with his wife, and for that reason uncontrollably jealous. Once, when his wife was alone, a vision of God appeared to her in the likeness of a beautiful young man, tall in stature, and announced good news to her, that by the providence of God she would bear a son, handsome and manifestly strong, under whom the Philistines would suffer once he had grown to manhood. He instructed her not to let his hair be cut. This would be, for him, an abstention imposed by God's command with respect to one kind of drink, but he would have a natural affinity for water alone. Having said this, he departed, having come in accordance with the will of God. When her husband returned, she related to him what the angel had said, marveling at the young man's beauty and stature, so that from her praises he was thrown into a state of alarm through jealousy, and the suspicion natural to such a feeling took hold of him. Wishing to put an end to her husband's unreasonable distress, she implored God to send the angel again, so that her husband might also see him. By the grace of God, the angel came again while they were in the field, and appeared to the woman when she was alone, her husband being elsewhere. She asked him to wait so that she could bring her husband, and when he agreed, she went to fetch Mano. When he saw him, even this did not put an end to his suspicion, and he asked that the angel reveal to him too whatever he had told his wife. The angel replied that it would be enough for her alone to know it. But when Mano asked him to say who he was, so that when the child was born they might show him gratitude and give him a gift, he said he had no need of anything, since he had not brought this good news in expectation of reward concerning the birth of the child. Mano then urged him to stay and share in hospitality, and though the angel did not agree at first, he was persuaded by his insistence to remain, so that Mano might bring him some gift of hospitality. Mano sacrificed a kid and told his wife to roast it, and when everything was ready, the angel directed that the loaves and the meat be set out on the rock, apart from the vessels. When this was done, he touched the meat with the staff he held, and flame shot up and consumed it along with the loaves, and the angel went up to heaven through the smoke as though through a chariot, visible to them both. Mano, afraid that some harm might come to them from having seen God, was reassured by his wife, who told him to take courage, since God would not have let himself be seen by them except for their benefit. And she conceived and kept the commands she had been given, and when the child was born they called him Samson, a name that signifies strong. The boy grew, he grew easily, and it was clear from his moderate diet and his unshorn hair that he would become a prophet. Traveling with his parents to Thamna, a city of the Philistines, while a festival was underway, he fell in love with a young woman of the place and urged his parents to arrange a marriage with her for him. They refused because she was not of his own people, but since God intended this marriage for the advantage of the Hebrews, his desire prevailed and he became engaged to the girl. Going often to visit her parents, he came upon a lion and, though unarmed, met it and strangled it with his bare hands, then threw the carcass into a wooded spot off the road. Going again to see the girl, he found a swarm of bees that had nested in the lion's carcass, and taking 3 honeycombs along with the other gifts he was bringing, he gave them to the girl. At the wedding feast, for he entertained all the Thamnites, 30 of the sturdiest young men were given to him, ostensibly as companions, but in fact as guards, for fear of the young man's strength, in case he should try to cause trouble. As the drinking went on and there was joking, as usually happens on such occasions, Samson said, "But let me put a riddle to you. If you solve it within 7 days of searching, I will give each of you linen garments and robes as the prize for your cleverness." Eager both to seem clever and to win the prize, they asked him to state it. He said that the all-devouring had produced from itself something sweet to eat, though it was itself thoroughly repellent. When for 3 days they were unable to find the answer, they urged the girl to learn it from her husband and reveal it to them, and indeed they threatened to burn her if she failed to do this. Samson, when the girl begged him to tell her, at first tried to hold out, but when she pressed him and broke into tears, taking this refusal to speak as proof of his ill will toward her, he told her about his killing of the lion and how he had taken from it 3 honeycombs and brought them to her. She, suspecting nothing treacherous, revealed the whole matter, and she in turn disclosed the answer to those who had begged it of her. So on the 7th day, on which the riddle had to be explained to him, before the sun set they came together and said, "Nothing is more repellent to those who encounter it than a lion, and nothing sweeter to those who taste it than honey." And Samson said, "Nothing is more treacherous than a woman, since she is the one who has revealed our secret to you." He gave them what he had promised, having made spoil of the Ascalonites who happened to meet him along the road, for they too are Philistines. But he renounced that marriage, and the girl, despising him for his anger, lived instead with his friend, the one who had acted as his groomsman. Enraged at this insult, Samson resolved to take vengeance on all the Philistines together with her. It was summer, and the crops were already ripe for harvest, so he caught 300 foxes, tied lighted torches to their tails, and released them into the fields of the Philistines. The crop was destroyed in this way, and when the Philistines learned that this was Samson's work and the reason he had done it, they sent their leaders to Thamna and burned alive the woman who had been his wife, together with her relatives, as being responsible for the disaster. Samson killed many Philistines on the plain and then settled at Edam, a fortified rock in the territory of Judah. The Philistines marched against that tribe. When the men of Judah protested that it was unjust to make them pay the penalty for Samson's offenses when they themselves paid tribute, the Philistines said that, if they wished to be free of blame, they must hand Samson over to them. Wanting to avoid any charge against themselves, 3,000 armed men came to the rock and, reproaching him for what he had dared against the Philistines, men able to bring disaster on the whole race of the Hebrews, said they had come to seize him and hand him over, and they urged him to submit to this willingly. He, after taking oaths from them that they would do nothing further to him themselves, but only deliver him into the hands of the enemy, came down from the rock and placed himself in the power of his own tribesmen. They bound him with 2 new ropes and led him off to hand him over to the Philistines. When they reached a place now called Jawbone because of the feat of valor Samson performed there, though before that it had no name, with the Philistines encamped not far off, coming out to meet him with joy and shouting as though their wishes had been accomplished, Samson snapped his bonds, snatched up a donkey's jawbone lying at his feet, charged the enemy, and striking them with the jawbone, killed about 1,000 of them, and put the rest to flight in confusion. But Samson, thinking too highly of himself for this deed, said that it had not come about through God's cooperation, but credited his own courage for what had happened, boasting that some of the enemy had fallen and others had fled from fear of him alone. Then, overtaken by a violent thirst, he came to recognize that human excellence is nothing before God, and he confessed all of this and pleaded that God, not taking his words in anger, should not deliver him into the hands of the enemy, but should provide help against his distress and rescue him from his trouble. Moved by his supplication, God sent up a sweet and abundant spring from a certain rock, and for this reason Samson called the place Jawbone, and it is still called that to this day. After this battle, Samson, holding the Philistines in contempt, went to Gaza and stayed in one of the inns there. When the leaders of Gaza learned of his presence there, they set an ambush before the gates so that he would not slip away unnoticed when he left. Samson, however, for their scheme did not escape him, rose about the middle of the night, tore loose the gates together with their very doorposts and bars and all the other woodwork around them, hoisted the whole mass onto his shoulders, and carried it to the mountain above Hebron, where he set it down. He had by now begun to transgress the customs of his fathers and to corrupt his own way of life through imitation of foreign practices, and this became for him the beginning of disaster. Falling in love with a woman among the Philistines who worked as a prostitute, named Delilah, he lived with her. The leaders of the Philistine community came to her, and with promises, persuaded her to learn from Samson the source of the strength that made him unassailable by his enemies. Over wine and in their intimacy, she pretended to marvel at his exploits and worked to discover by what means he so surpassed others in strength. Samson, still keeping his wits about him, deceived her in turn, saying that if he were bound with 7 fresh vine withes still supple enough to be twisted around him, he would become weaker than any man. She said nothing for the moment, but having reported this to the Philistine leaders, she stationed some soldiers inside the house, and while he was drunk, bound him tightly with the withes in the strongest manner she could, then woke him and told him that some men were coming upon him. He snapped the withes and tried to defend himself as though enemies were indeed attacking. When Samson kept coming to her, the woman said it was a terrible thing that, out of distrust in his affection for her, he would not tell her what she asked, since she would not keep silent about anything he thought it better she not know. When he deceived her again, saying he would lose his strength if bound with 7 new ropes, and this too, when tried, achieved nothing, she pressed him a third time, and he told her that if his hair were woven together, it would take away his strength. When this too proved false at her final pleading, Samson, for he was fated to meet with disaster, wishing to gratify Delilah, said, God cares for me, and having been born by his providence, I grow this hair because God commanded that it not be cut, for my strength depends on its growing and remaining uncut. Learning this and cutting off his hair, she handed him over to the enemy, no longer strong enough to fend off their assault. They gouged out his eyes and led him off in bonds. As time passed, Samson's hair grew back. During a public festival of the Philistines, when their leaders and most prominent men were feasting together in a hall supported by 2 pillars, Samson was sent for and brought into the banquet so that they could mock him over their drinking. He, considering it a worse misfortune not to be able to avenge himself for the abuse than the abuse itself, persuaded the boy who guided him by the hand, saying he needed to rest from weariness, to bring him close to the pillars. When he arrived there, he threw himself against them, and the house collapsed as the pillars gave way, killing 3,000 men, all of whom died, and Samson among them. Such was the end that overtook him, after he had led the Israelites for 20 years. It is right to admire the man for his courage, his strength, and the greatness of spirit he showed at his death, as well as the anger he maintained against his enemies right up to the moment of dying. His capture through a woman ought to be attributed to human nature, which is too weak to resist such faults, but this should not obscure the credit due to him for his surpassing excellence in everything else. His relatives took up his body and buried it in Zora, his homeland, with the tombs of his ancestors. After Samson's death, Eli the high priest became leader of the Israelites. In his time, when the land was suffering from famine, a man named Elimelech from Bethlehem, a city belonging to the tribe of Judah, unable to bear the hardship, moved with his wife Naomi and the sons born to him by her, Chilion and Mahlon, to the land of Moab. As his affairs prospered there, he took Moabite wives for his sons, Orpah for Chilion and Ruth for Mahlon. 10 years later, Elimelech and, soon after him, his sons died one after another, and Naomi, grieving bitterly over what had happened and unable to bear the loss of her loved ones before her eyes, the very reason she had left her homeland, decided to return to it, since she had now heard that things there had turned out well. Her daughters-in-law could not bear to be separated from her, and though she urged them not to, she could not persuade them to give up their wish to go with her. But as they pressed her, she prayed that they might find a happier marriage than the one they had missed with her own sons, and the acquisition of other blessings, given how matters stood for her, and urged them to remain there rather than share in uncertain fortunes by abandoning their native land. So Orpah stayed, but Ruth would not be persuaded, and Naomi took her along to share whatever fate might bring. When Ruth arrived with her mother-in-law in Bethlehem, Boaz, a relative of Elimelech, received them as guests. When people greeted Naomi by name, she said, "You should more rightly call me Mara," for in the Hebrew tongue Naomi means good fortune and Mara means grief. When the harvest came, Ruth went out to glean with her mother-in-law's permission so that they might have food, and she happened to come to the field of Boaz. Soon after, Boaz arrived and, seeing the girl, asked the field overseer about her. The overseer, having already learned everything from her a little earlier, told his master. Boaz, out of goodwill toward the mother-in-law and in memory of her son, whom Ruth had married, greeted her and prayed that good fortune would come to her. He did not think it fitting that she should merely glean, but allowed her to reap whatever she could and to keep it, instructing the overseer not to hinder her from taking grain and to provide her with food and drink whenever he fed the reapers. Ruth took the grain he gave her and kept it for her mother-in-law, and came home late bringing it along with the ears she had gleaned. Naomi, too, had saved her portions of certain foods with which the neighbors had looked after her. Ruth told her also what Boaz had said to her. When Naomi learned that he was a relative and might well, out of piety, look after them, Ruth went out again on the following days to gather ears of grain along with the maidservants of Boaz. Not many days later, Boaz himself came and, since the barley had already been threshed, lay down to sleep on the thrashing floor. Learning of this, Naomi contrived to have Ruth lie down near him, for she said it would turn out well for them if he came to know the girl, and she sent her to sleep at his feet. Ruth, considering it improper to object to anything her mother-in-law commanded, went and for a time escaped the notice of Boaz, who was sleeping deeply. But waking around midnight and becoming aware of someone lying beside him, he asked who it was. When she told him her name and said that her master permitted this, he then kept quiet. But early, before the servants began to stir for work, he woke her and told her to take as much barley as she could carry and go to her mother-in-law before anyone saw that she had been sleeping there, since it was prudent to guard against slander on such matters, especially about things that had not happened. "But concerning the whole matter," he said, "it will be settled thus. I will ask the man who is my nearest relative whether he needs you as a wife, and if he says yes, you will follow him, but if he declines, according to the law, I will take you as my own." When she told this to her mother-in-law, good cheer took hold of them in the hope that Boaz would look after them. And he, when the day was already half over, went down into the city, gathered the elders, and, sending for Ruth, called the kinsmen as well. And when he arrived, Boaz said, "Do you hold the inheritance of Elimelech and his sons?" When he agreed that the laws permitted this by right of kinship, Boaz said, "Then it is not right to remember only half the laws, but to do everything according to them. For a woman has come here from Moab, and if you wish to hold the fields, you must marry her, according to the laws." He ceded to Boaz both the inheritance and the woman, since Boaz too was a relative of the dead, but he said that he himself already had a wife and children. So Boaz, calling the elders to witness, told the woman to come forward, remove his sandal, according to the law, and spit in his face. When this was done, Boaz married Ruth, and after a year a son was born to them. Naomi, who nursed him, on the advice of the women named him Obed, since he was to be raised for her support in old age, for Obed in the Hebrew tongue means one who serves. To Obed was born a son, Jesse, and to Jesse, David, who became king and left the rule to his own descendants for 21 generations of men. I have told the story of Ruth as a matter of necessity, wishing to show the power of God, that he is able to advance even ordinary people to splendid rank, as he raised up David from such origins. The Hebrews, now that their affairs had again taken a turn for the worse, went to war once more with the Philistines, for the following reason. Eli, the high priest, had two sons, Hophni and Phinehas. These men, insolent toward their fellow men and impious toward the divine, abstained from no wrongdoing. Some of the offerings they took as their due honor, but others they seized outright as plunder, and the women who came to worship they abused, forcing themselves on some and seducing others with gifts. Their way of life fell short of tyranny in nothing. Their father himself was deeply troubled by this, expecting that punishment from God would come upon them at any moment for what they were doing, and the people at large were distressed as well. And when God revealed to his servants Eli and the young prophet Samuel the disaster that was coming, Eli then openly mourned over his sons. But I wish first to relate the story of the prophet before going on to tell what happened to Eli's sons and the calamity that befell the whole people of the Hebrews. Elkanah, a Levite, a man of middling standing among the citizens of the tribal portion of Ephraim, who lived in the city of Ramatim, had married two wives, Hannah and Peninnah. By the latter he had children, but the other, who was childless, he continued to love. When Elkanah went up with his wives to the city of Shiloh to sacrifice, for the tabernacle of God had been set up there, as we have said before, and again, at the feast, as he was distributing portions of meat to the wives and children, Hannah, seeing the other wife's children seated about their mother, burst into tears and lamented her own childlessness and isolation. Overcoming her husband's attempts to console her grief, she went to the tabernacle to entreat God to grant her offspring and make her a mother, promising to dedicate her firstborn to the service of God, to live a manner of life unlike that of ordinary people. While she spent a long time at her prayers, Eli the high priest, for he sat before the tabernacle, supposing her drunk, ordered her to leave. She replied that she had drunk only water, but that grieved at her want of children, she was entreating God. Eli then encouraged her to take heart, declaring that God would grant her children. Returning to her husband full of hope, she took food joyfully, and when they had gone back to their homeland, she conceived, and a son was born to them, whom they named Samuel, one might render it, asked of God. They came, then, to offer sacrifice for the child's birth and to bring the tithes. And the woman, remembering the vow she had made concerning the child, handed him over to Eli, dedicating him to God to become a prophet. His hair was accordingly left uncut, and his drink was water. And Samuel was raised, living in the temple, while to Elkanah by Hannah sons were born as well and three daughters. When Samuel had already completed his 12th year, he began to prophesy. Once, as he lay sleeping, God called him by name. Thinking he had been summoned by the high priest, he came to him. But when the high priest said he had not called him, God did this a third time. Then Eli, enlightened, said to him, "I, Samuel, have kept silence as before, but it is God who is calling. Answer him and say that I am here." And when God spoke again, Samuel, having heard, asked leave to speak of what he had been told, for he said he would not fail those who asked of him whatever service they wished. And God said, "Since you are here, learn of a disaster that is to come upon the Israelites. greater than words and beyond the belief of those who hear of it. The sons of Eli will die on a single day, and the priesthood will pass to the house of Eleazar, for Eli loved his sons more than my service and against their own good." Eli forced the prophet under oath to tell him these things, for Samuel had not wished to grieve him by speaking, and thereby he came to hold an even firmer expectation of the loss of his children. Samuel's reputation grew ever greater, as all that he had prophesied was seen to come true. At that time, the Philistines took the field against the Israelites and encamped near the city of Aphek. The Israelites went out to meet them after a short delay, and on the following day they engaged. The Philistines won and killed about 4,000 of the Hebrews and pursued the rest of the host to their camp. Fearing for their whole cause, the Hebrews sent to the elders and the high priest, ordering that the Ark of God be brought, so that with it present they might overpower their enemies in battle. Not knowing that he who had decreed their disaster was greater than the ark, on whose account the ark's presence would come to nothing. So the ark came, and with it the sons of the high priest, their father having instructed them, if they wished to live should the ark be taken, not to appear before him again. Phinehas was already serving as priest, his father having yielded the office to him because of his old age. Great courage now came upon the Hebrews, as though through the ark's arrival they would prevail over their enemies, while the enemies were struck with dread, fearing the ark's presence among the Israelites. Yet the outcome did not match either side's expectations. When the armies met, the victory the Hebrews had hoped for went to the Philistines, and the defeat the Philistines had feared, the Hebrews suffered, and learned that they had put their trust in the ark in vain. For they were at once routed when they came to close quarters with the enemy, and lost about 30,000 men, among whom fell the sons of the high priest as well, and the ark was carried off by the enemy. When the defeat was reported at Shiloh, and the capture of the ark, for a young man of Benjamin came to them as messenger, having been present at what had happened, the whole city was filled with mourning. And Eli the high priest, who sat by one of the gates on a lofty seat, hearing the wailing and supposing that something more serious had happened to his own household, sent for the young man. And when he learned the outcome of the battle, he bore it more easily, since he had already learned from God what would happen to his sons around the camp, and had foretold it. For foreknowledge lessens the sting of misfortunes that come as expected. But when he heard that the ark too had been captured by the enemy, overwhelmed by grief at this blow falling upon him against all hope, he fell backward from his seat and died, having lived 98 years in all, of which he had held the office 40. On that same day, there also died the wife of his son Phinehas, unable to go on living after her husband's misfortune. Word of what had befallen her husband reached her while she was pregnant, and she gave birth to a 7-month child, who, when he lived, they named Ichabod, the name signifying without glory, on account of the disgrace that had then fallen upon the army. Eli was the first to rule as high priest from the house of Ithamar, the other son of Aaron. For the house of Eleazar had held the priesthood first, a son receiving the honor from his father. Eleazar handed it down to his son Phinehas, after whom Abiezer, his son, received the honor and left it to his own son, named Bucky, from whom it passed to Uzi, his son, after whom Eli held the priesthood, of whom our account now speaks. And the line from him continued down to the time of Solomon's reign. Then the house of Eleazar recovered it once more.